Welcome to Flicks of Doom, the official movie podcast of Geeks of Doom. I'm Empress Eve, and here with me is my very own personal fruity pebble, Justin Vactor.
Yeah!
Woo! We have a very special episode for you. It's Robert Rodriguez-themed episode, and we'll be talking about his new movie, Machete, as well as looking back at his previous films like the Mexico Trilogy and Planetara. We'll also be talking a little bit about the box office and how his movie did at the box office, and also some movie news this week. So, Justin, why don't you tell our listeners how to find us?
They can email us at flicksofdoom@gmail.com. They can follow us on Twitter, flicksofdoom. And if any of these are with a CK, then you're sending it to the wrong place. It's flicks with an X. And you can also subscribe to us in iTunes or on the Zune Marketplace. If anybody has a Zune out there, you can subscribe there as well. And don't forget, leave us a review in the iTunes store. It also helps us. Also, visit us at geeksofdoom.com for some lovely updates on movies, comics, and everything else. So this is going to be our low-budget episode of the podcast, Eve.
It is. How much do we have to work with? How much did Robert Rodriguez, the producer, get for us to work on this episode?
Nothing.
So how much cereal money did you get this week?
Well, as always, I have an unlimited cereal budget, so I got some lovely additions to my cupboard, and I found Honey Nut Chex and a marshmallow Fruity Pebbles, which I had never seen before, so that's new to my cereal collection.
Well, I heard that Booberry is making a comeback. Have you heard about that?
I haven't heard this news, and I'm not a fan of that cereal.
Oh, no? Do you like the other ones?
I don't
like
Count Chocula. I don't like the strawberry one. I don't like the actual cereals, but the commercials, when I was a kid, I was always a big fan of all of those.
Me too. I actually was too. But I like Frankenberry. And there was that other one. I can't think of the name of it, but it was a fruity one with the mummy on it, right? That was pretty good. But you never really saw that anywhere. You can't really get it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what else needs to come back? Vanilla Cookie Crisp. Okay?
I've never heard of this.
Did you ever have Cookie Crisp?
Yeah, I've had Cookie Crisp before.
Okay, well, this is the vanilla version.
How do you do a vanilla version of that?
I don't know, but it was good. It was really good. There's no chocolate chips in it. It's a vanilla cookie.
All right. I'll take your word for it. I think you were dreaming at that time.
No, I was not.
Yeah.
I was not dreaming of Vanilla Cookie Crisp. It did exist.
No.
All right. Whatever you say.
No.
So, because of Labor Day weekend here in the United States, it was kind of slow news week. So, we picked a few little tidbits that we wanted to talk about. One is actually ties into our Robert Rodriguez theme, kind of. So, Justin, why don't you tell us about the news this week?
Tom Cruise and James McAvoy are both wanted for the At the Mountains of Madness adaptation that's coming out. They're trying to decide which would be a better fit.
I don't know. I think neither. I wouldn't want either one of these actors in this film. I mean, definitely, we're at the point where when you say Tom Cruise, people don't take it seriously anymore, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, with the exception of Les Grossman, which a lot of people didn't realize was Tom Cruise at first.
Right.
He doesn't have a lot of power in Hollywood right now.
No, I mean, unless he's going to do sequels to his films like Mission Impossible, things he's already done. I feel like whenever they, you know, if you put him in something new, people just, I don't know, it's like, he just isn't viable as an action hero for new franchises anymore. So I feel like if they put him in this one, you know, I don't know. I think it would turn people off. And then James McAvoy, I don't know. He was okay in Wanted. He's better in those period dramas, I think, right? Like Atonement and things like that.
Mm.
In this one, I think there'll be action because, you know, they come up against serious business here in this movie. But I think a lot of it is suspense. It's going to be very suspenseful. So it has to be an actor that can pull that off, like seeming frightened and seeming, you know, like freaked out and things like that for this type of story. Mm. So I don't know. What do you think of these two choices?
Out of these two, I would prefer Tom Cruise just because I like Tom Cruise as a personality rather than James McAvoy. But I don't know too much about the character, so James McAvoy may be a better fit. I don't know. I'm not too familiar with H.P. Lovecraft's work, so it could be either one.
It definitely is not... The lead character in the story is really... he's really the narrator. He's really... Like, I mean, he's in it, but he's telling, like... He's telling what he witnessed, basically. So... It has to be a person that's not this big personality. That's why I think, like, I like Tom Cruise too, actually. I have no problem with him, and I like his movies, and I enjoy them, and so I don't have a problem with him. But I think he might be too big of a personality for this type of movie. And the bigger issue is that the studio, which is Universal in this case, and Del Toro, they're the ones that are butting heads on who they want to be the lead. So, you know, that's never really good if the filmmaker is butting heads already with the studio at such an early stage. Mm-hmm. So that's a little, I don't know, not too good.
Yeah.
But this is so far in advance. I mean, chances are we'll be hearing a lot of different casting news coming out of this one. I think filming doesn't begin until May 2011, so they have a lot of time to pick somebody.
Yeah, let's hope it's Tom Cruise. I think he's a better actor anyway.
All right, so what else we got?
If you are a fan of Clive Barker, there's a remake of Hellraiser that had been announced, but it may be doomed.
So... our readers should be happy about that, but no, I am a Clive Barker fan. I've read a lot of his books, and I enjoy the movies. Well, for the most part, the movies based on his novels. And in this one, I'm really not surprised that there's problems. I don't know. From the beginning, this remake of Hellraiser, which I've said it before, and I'll probably be saying it again many times, I don't really like remakes, and I find them for the most part unnecessary, but that's just my opinion. But I understand that they need to do it to update it for today's audiences and sort of reinvigorate them. And I know you haven't seen the original Hellraiser, so I would be very curious to see what you think of it at this point, having never seen it before. But I enjoyed the first one and the second one. I even enjoyed the third and fourth Hellraisers, where I love it because part four, they go to space. You know, I love that. But yeah. But I've actually met Clive Barker many times. And the last time I met him, I was talking to him about how they've done numerous direct-to-DVD sequels to Hellraiser, which he has no part of it whatsoever. Like, he's not a producer, nothing. Like, they just basically took his property and ran it into the ground in the direct-to-DVD market. And, you know, I mentioned it to him, and he was like, oh, yeah, they're just so terrible, and I have nothing to do with it, and I wash my hands of it, and, he definitely... You know, but he apparently doesn't have a problem with doing a remake of Hellraiser, but it just doesn't seem to be going very well. They can't seem to find somebody to direct it that they feel is appropriate for it. So, you know how these things go. Eventually, actually, the studio could lose the rights of Hellraiser, which is Dimension is doing it. They could lose the rights if they don't hurry up and move on doing a movie. So they're going to have to make a decision eventually, or they'll lose it, and it might go and, you know, die, and we'll never see a Hellraiser remake. So, but yeah, Justin, get on that original one, and then we're going to have to talk about it on another episode.
I do remember being scared of Pinhead when I was a kid.
And you should be. Okay. I'll tell you that much. I'm still scared. Yep. So what's our last bit of news?
The Grindhouse fake trailer, Hobo with a Shotgun, got a Not Safe for Work trailer released this week.
Yeah, actually, not only did it get a... they released the original trailer, which, in case people don't know, when Grindhouse came out, when they did, it was Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino, they did a double feature called Grindhouse in the theaters, and it was Death Proof and Planet Terror. And during the showing, they had a bunch of fake trailers. And one of them, they're apparently, I didn't realize this, but there was more than what we got to see. Like, I saw four of them. Apparently, there were more created. And this one, Hobo with a Shotgun, the person that created it is Canadian, and it was shown in theaters in Canada. And now, they're actually doing a movie for it. With Rutger Hauer as the hobo with the shotgun. So the trailer for that movie was just released. So did you get a chance to look at it, Justin?
Yeah, I did. I was, when I first saw it, I said, wait a minute, I don't remember seeing this during the Grindhouse double feature. And then, I did some more research. And this guy, Jason Eisner, won a contest at South by Southwest for the best trailer. So it's amazing that he won a contest. Now it's being turned into a full movie.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I mean, it just goes to show you never know. All of you aspiring filmmakers, right? You never know what could come of it. I mean, they're making the Thanksgiving, the one that was the Thanksgiving trailer that Eli Roth, I think, did, right? Yeah. They're making a movie out of that. And then, of course, Machete was one of these spoof trailers that played. It's actually, if you get the DVD for Death Proof, no, not Death Proof. If you get Planet Terror, if you get Robert Rodriguez's Planet Terror, it actually is on there. It begin, like when you press play, it immediately starts right before the movie. So you could see it there. And of course, I think it's all over YouTube, right? So,
yeah.
But this one with Rutger Hauer was pretty fun. It's pretty funny. I got a kick out of it.
Well, are they doing too many of these now, Eve? Now that we've seen Machete, and we'll talk about our thoughts on the movie later, are they doing too many of these where it was fine as a trailer, but turning it into a full movie? I don't know.
I don't think they're doing too many at this point because they haven't done all that many. But just like other trends in Hollywood, you know, I'm really not surprised if next thing you know, you see a slew of fake trailers to make you laugh. And, you know, basically, it's these trailers are poking fun at stereotypes in movies. And so the fact that they're now making movies out of that, it's like, so all you're doing is making movies out of stereotypes of movies, thereby making a stereotypical movie. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if they run with it, which I really hope they don't, because it'll be really stupid if they do. But I mean, this one looks pretty funny, and I think for now it's okay. But yeah, you're right. If they go crazy with it, then forget it. It'll be we don't need that. But yeah, it was a slow news week, so really wasn't much else happening, right, Justin?
Yeah.
So, all right. So what else we got, Justin?
As we saw, it was a slow week in news. It was also a slow week at the box office as The American came in first with $13 million and Takers openings. It was at its second weekend. It made $11 million. Machete, the movie we're going to be talking about, came in third with $11 million. And to round out the top five, The Last Exorcism made $7 million. And then Going the Distance, which was the other new movie that opened at a wide release, disappointing fifth at $6.8 million.
So are you surprised that The American took the top slot this week?
I guess it was a toss-up for me. I didn't think Takers would do as well as it did, but I thought it was going to be between The American and Machete, which it was on Friday, and then the weekend, Takers just narrowly grazed above it. Takers came in $11.4 million. Machete made $11.3 million. So it just barely beat it for second place. But I thought it would have been a closer race, I guess.
Right. I'm pretty surprised that Takers is still going strong. That's first of all. Mm-hmm. And The Last Exorcism too. Like, that's pretty surprising that it's still going strong in its second week. And well, I guess I didn't even think it was going to do that great to begin with, but I don't know. Never underestimate the power of faux documentary horror, right?
I figured it was going to do well because we saw that with Blair Witch Project and we saw that with Paranormal Activity. Those exact same type of movies were made on a shoestring budget, speaking of Robert Rodriguez.
Right.
And they made tons at the box office. So they're very profitable. And this is just continuing that trend so far.
Well, I mean, I guess it's not surprising that The American came in first because it is a George Clooney movie, right? I don't really know much about it. I didn't get to see it, but I know you did, right?
Yeah, I did. I think they marketed it as a James Bond or a Jason Bourne movie, and it's really not that at all. Oh. It's a lot more of a slow burn, and I enjoyed it, but I can see some people going into it with the wrong expectation and being disappointed by it because the pace is so slow.
Oh, okay. But, so it's not an action movie, really?
No, it's a thriller. And George Clooney, he's playing a spy and there's a whole bunch of people after him. And then the first scene of the movie is they kill the girl he loves and he's
trying to get away
from it. So he's kind of detached the rest of the movie because of what happened in the opening scene. Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, this movie opened up on Wednesday. So it actually, so those numbers include Wednesday and Thursday, right?
I'm not sure exactly how they did that. It had those two extra days, but it didn't finish very far ahead of the other ones.
Right. Yeah, it didn't. So, I mean, I think they do count it, right? That's why sometimes they do that. They open up days in advance so that they could get a jump on it.
I don't know whose
radar this movie was on, actually.
I think sometimes they'll open it on a Wednesday, but then they'll only count the weekend, and then they'll do the 5-day numbers separately sometimes. But
right.
I'm looking at Last Exorcism. The budget was $1.8 million, and it's made $32.4 so far.
Mm.
So that's... They can just continue that
trend. They can keep making those handheld, up-your-nose movies. So actually, Machete did pretty well then, I would think, under the circumstances, right?
Yeah, I would have put it first myself if I was rating the weekends, but...
Really?
Sure.
All right, so why don't we talk a little bit about it then?
Yeah! The movie Machete, as we mentioned earlier, was based on a fake trailer that played during the Grindhouse double feature a few years ago, which both Eve and I got a chance to partake in. And if you didn't, I feel sorry for you because you just can't really have that experience at home that you had in the theater. But the plot is the exact same as what you saw in the fake trailer. It's Danny Trejo playing this ex-federale who gets set up, and he has to go for revenge against the people who set him up. So it's a bunch of killing, action, gratuitous violence, and gratuitous nudity. Yeah.
Oh, and I know you love that.
Yeah.
There's a few F-bombs, right, I think, in this movie?
Oh, a few.
Did you cover your ears?
No. Eve, that's just like having a conversation with you. It's the same thing.
That's true. Yeah. That is true. So you're used to it by now.
Yeah.
All right. That's good. So I'm good for something, see? Well, I think now that I've seen the movie and then I went back and I rewatched the fake trailer, I realized how really they stuck to the plot of the fake trailer. I think there was only one part, I think, that I saw in the trailer that didn't make it to the movie. I think it was like where they had that guy, I think they had him up against like a chainsaw kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that was, I don't remember seeing that in the film, but in the film they make it seem like he's basically a day laborer. He's a Mexican day laborer and he's living in Texas, and he really is just going about his life after, you know, horrible circumstances happen in Mexico to make him lose his job and his family and everything else. And they do present it that he is just living his life. He's not out for revenge at first, right? And he is just you know, trying to make a living. And then this whole opportunity comes up. Like, basically, he gets an offer he can't refuse. Mm. And then that goes wrong. And then that's when he has to get revenge after that. It's not like he's like, I'm the vigilante, or I'm, you know, you hire me and I kill everybody. That they kind of made it seem that way a little bit in the trailer, where it's like, oh, this is the guy that you get and he kills everybody. But like, that's not really what he was. He wasn't like this mass murderer who's like, you know, hire me and I wipe everybody out. But he is good with a machete, though. That's for sure. Yeah. That's how he got his name. You know, he's like, I don't need a gun. Give me the blade. So,
yeah.
So what'd you think of it?
I had a lot of fun, just like I did at the Grindhouse double feature and like I did at Piranha 3D a couple weeks ago, the same type of B-movie exploitation style that we saw in those movies was the exact same thing we saw in Machete, and I am a fan of that style, so I think this is a well-done entry into that series of type, or that style of movies, I should say. So I enjoyed it for the most part, but if there was one flaw with the movie, I would say it was, for me, it ran a little too long.
I agree.
After a while, I said, okay, I'm enjoying this, and I get the joke, but it felt like they stretched it out a little too far, and I almost feel like it worked better as the fake trailer than it did as a full-length movie, because I would have, I mean, when that fake trailer came on during Grindhouse, I cheered and I loved it, but I didn't say to myself, okay, now I want to see that full movie.
Right.
That wasn't what I said to myself, but I don't know. I felt like there were one too many storylines added to it, because if they had actually just stuck to the plain story that they had in the trailer, I think that would have shaved off some time and that would have tightened it up a little bit. And it might have made it a nicer movie for me, but they ended up adding so many characters to it, and adding so many, with all those different characters came all these different plot lines. You had Michelle Rodriguez and her whole underground movement that was going on with She, and you had Jessica Alba working for the government and whatever. And then there was just a whole bunch of things. Johnson's whole thing. And so that's what I felt like. There was just too many of those things added in, and it almost felt like they gave Robert Rodriguez too much freedom, and they didn't reel him in.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. Absolutely. I think I was enjoying the movie, and for what it is, right? I'm enjoying it and everything. And then all of a sudden, it felt like, okay, now is where it should wind down.
Yeah.
Now it's where it should end, and we should complete this story. And you're right, it kept going, and that's when I felt a little overloaded. I was like, okay, now I've had enough. Like, how many, you know, first of all, enough of the gratuitous violence. Like, all right, how many things, limbs are we going to see chopped off? How much machine gun fire? You know, it's like, okay, enough is enough already. That's first of all. And then second of all, like you said, with all the different little subplots going on with everybody, you start to kind of lose interest. You're like, okay, you know, you're not resolving any of these plot lines, and I'm starting to, you know, like, there's so much gunfire that, you know, in the end, you start to almost not care. You're like, you start to not even care about him as a character. You're like, all right, I've had enough of him. So yeah, I definitely agree with you. It went on way too long.
The movie has a 105 minute running time. I think it should not have gone over 90 minutes.
Yeah. No,
at all.
It shouldn't have. I think it could have gotten away with like 85.
Oh yeah,
minutes,
yeah. I wouldn't have been mad if it was 60 minutes or 70 minutes. But
right.
Yeah, I think they pushed it a little bit too far. Typical Robert Rodriguez fashion. The budget was $25 million, and so far it's only made $14 million. So that's of course the opening box office.
I feel like he didn't even need. Did he really need $25 million? I don't know.
Yeah, that even seems a little high for him.
For him, right?
Yeah, going off of his previous work, most of the Spy Kids he got for around $30 million. But
you know, maybe it was because he had to pay people like Robert De Niro, right? I don't know. It could that could have been it. They're actually this was a pretty big ensemble cast, I would say. I mean, they had you know, Steven Seagal, they had Lindsay Lohan, Don Johnson, Jessica Alba, Cheech Marin, Jeff Fahey, and Danny Trejo. So they had a lot of people in this movie that maybe that's why it was a little high. And plus, I don't know. Maybe machine guns are more money now. That faux machine gun fire is more money these days.
Yeah, that's but, all CG stuff, yeah.
Yeah. That, maybe that's it.
I enjoyed the cast for the most part, but did you get the sense, I don't know, I'm asking you right now, so I'm about to find out, but I don't know if you got the same feeling as I did where I felt like some people were taking their performance up two steps further than the other people were in the movie. Like, I felt like Robert De Niro was way over the top, mm-hmm. and someone like Michelle Rodriguez wasn't as much, and Jessica Alba was somewhere in the middle. I felt like certain people, they felt like they were in a different movie almost, because they were so over the top. Did you get that
sense?
Yeah,
I agree. Yeah, I think Robin De Niro was definitely over the top in this film, and I think part of the reason for that is that his character itself was sort of playing a character, and so I think that was part of the problem. And I also think that Robert De Niro shouldn't try to be a Texan.
Yeah.
That's first of all. And I definitely think Jessica Alba, she was a little too much too. Like, I don't know what she was going for. Mm. Like, she didn't behave like your typical law enforcement officer. It was almost like her character in the beginning when she's watching at the taco truck. It seems like she was very naive. Like, I actually was thinking, how would they actually place her on this type of assignment? Like, I wouldn't even think she would get this type of assignment. And so I thought she was a little over the top, like, trying to be, like, a good cop. Like, she was good cop and bad cop together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, and of course, I think people like Jeff Fahey, he's always over the top in every movie. Like, if you look, and he's in a lot of Robert Rodriguez's movie, so if you see, he's always over the top. So I think he just acted the way he always does in every film. But and Steven Seagal too. I think Steven Seagal was he was almost like a caricature of every character that he's ever played.
You know what I felt like with Steven Seagal? I almost felt like he was doing the same thing that Tom Cruise did with Tropic Thunder and that character, where. Yeah. He's someone that we haven't seen for a while. He had a lot of success earlier in his career, and then his career's kind of fizzled out over the past couple of years. Then he's coming back with this kind of funny, over-the-top role, and it puts him, at least in my mind, back in my good graces. And I'm like, oh, right. Yeah, I like Steven Seagal again. That's exactly how I felt. A lot of people, that was the way they perceived Tom Cruise after his whole jumping on the couch incident. And then he came back in Tropic Thunder, and then they were, oh, he's hilarious. We like him again.
Well, I think that, you know, I don't even know if that's what they were really attempting with Steven Seagal, but that's what happened. But I think they were going for that with Don Johnson, because how they made it in the credits, it said introducing Don Johnson.
Yeah.
That was like the big joke.
Yeah. I laughed at that one.
That was funny, but then his character, there was no way to even like that character at all, right? Like, the Steven Seagal character, you're like, yeah, he's a bad guy, but there's something about him that is, like, charismatic, so you're like, okay, he's the bad guy, but I kind of like him. Whereas Don Johnson, I don't know about you, but I hated him from the beginning, and he wasn't endeared to me at all, so he didn't make a comeback for me, in my eyes, you know?
Yeah. I could have seen the movie without him. That was one of those things I just thought was extra and wasn't necessary.
Well, you know who I thought did well, actually, who, if anything, this is good for her career, is Lindsay Lohan, because I think she did really good in this movie. I would have actually liked to see more of her character. And, you know, it was weird. In my theater, she was the only person that when you saw her face for the first time, everyone in the audience, like, just started to go, you know, and they were, like, talking, and, like, I don't know if it was because they didn't know she was in the movie or because you know, she's just someone who's always in the gossip columns, and they're like, oh, what is she doing? And I couldn't hear what people were saying, but definitely the audience, it got loud. Like, everyone started to talk and say things.
Yeah, well, I guess it's good for her career, but then at the same time, she keeps sabotaging her own career by continuing to get arrested, continuing to do drugs, and like, she just continues to do it. Whereas I think Tom Cruise, he's, in the last couple of years, we haven't heard as much as we were when he was jumping on couches and when he was doing all that stuff. And she, it seems like she's just continuing to sabotage herself.
Yeah.
I don't know if you saw, she wasn't even invited to the premiere.
No, I didn't know that.
Because of what she's currently going through. So that, you know, that's kind of, it's kind of sad to me for her, because I liked her in Mean Girls, and I liked her
in me too.
A lot of the stuff that she was doing at that time, I was a fan of. So it's kind of disheartening to see her now. And I really enjoyed the nudity in the movie, but in particular, they had the Lindsay Lohan body double, where whenever she was naked, she had her hair over her face.
Right.
I don't know if
But that wasn't really her fault, because if you look at the trailer, right, that's on the DVD for Planet Terror. If you look at the trailer, she was not in the trailer, but her character was. There was a woman there, like, that you see them in the pool with Machete, you know, and they're making out with him. It's a different actress, and she's nude. Mm-hmm. So I think that might be – well, first of all, I don't think Lindsay Lohan is going to do nude scenes, you know, for a movie like this.
No.
But, yeah, but it, I think it was the same. Like, actually, if you look at the trailer, you see there's a scene where Jeff Fahey's character is going, like, where's my wife and daughter? And next to him, you could see a picture of the wife and daughter, and it's not Lindsay Lohan in the picture. So yeah. I guess that was part of it, too. They were like, well, we already have that footage.
Yeah. So. Well, the point I was trying to bring up with when I said that was that people thought that was actually her. I've heard podcasts where people were like, and you get to see Lindsay Lohan naked in this movie. And they were trying to advertise that as part of the movie. And they just totally, that joke went over their heads, because Robert Rodriguez knows that it's a body double, and he knows that you know it's a body double. Mm. He definitely plays that for laughs, because that's one of those things that, like with Death Proof and Planet Terror, that whole grindhouse feel of making mistakes and just keeping, you know, just going with it.
Yeah, like when you could see a body double or stunt double, and it's so obvious it's not the real actor, but they don't care. They just leave it in anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I don't know why that podcast thought that, but yeah, they got fooled. So the audience out there, don't get fooled. Lindsay Lohan, it is not her body. But we do see Jessica Alba naked.
Well, you don't see her naked. Well, you see her.
No, she's naked.
No, but you don't see her boobs. No,
yeah, you do. You see half of it.
Well,
you're talking about, you don't see her nipple. That's a different thing. I didn't say you get to see her nipple. I said you get to see her
naked. It's a side shot of her in the shower and the way she's that's enough for you, I know. Yeah. The way she's positioned is that, I mean, you get a good look at her, but I wouldn't call it a nude scene.
No, like it's nude. Film. She's in the shower, guys. She's naked. So if you want to see Jessica Alba naked, go see
Machete. I don't know. I think that's false advertising right there.
And I really liked that she was on her laptop while she was in the shower. That was cool.
She was on a Mac.
Yeah.
She was on a MacBook.
And that's the type of thing you'll see in this movie. If you don't, from everything we've said so far, if you don't know what to expect, there's naked girls in the shower on their laptops. And the one scene that I will say, if you want to sum up this entire movie, it's when Danny Trejo punches a guy in the stomach, takes his intestine out, and then jumps out the window while holding on to the intestine. That is, for me, a summation of this movie. And that scene alone will decide whether you like the movie or not.
Well, I agree with you. It does sum up the movie quite well. But I also have to say that in the beginning, when we first started talking about the film, we both agreed that it probably would have been better had it been more bare bones. You know, this guy loses his family and his life from, you know, Steven Seagal's character pretty much, you know, does him in. And he survives through the ordeal. And now it would have been better had it just been more of a revenge story where it's like, now I'm going to do everything I can to get Steven Seagal and make him pay for what he's done to me. And I think that would have worked probably better. I mean, that's actually like Robert Rodriguez's his Desperado movie. That's what Desperado is. So I guess he would have basically been making Desperado again, but I think for this character it would have been better, because I think after a while you almost lose sight of Machete. You lose sight of him and what he's going through and like what his mission is. You lose sight of that because you have Robert De Niro as the senator, Texan senator, who he wants to build an electrified fence along the U.S.-Mexico border to keep illegal Mexicans out of the United States. And then you have his aide who's doing this underhanded thing to try to get more votes. And there was that whole concoction, the whole political concoction of it. You have Don Johnson's character, who basically like you can consider him and his group the KKK of, you know, Mexican Border Patrol, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have the whole Michelle Rodriguez's, her arc is she is like the underground railroad for Mexican immigrants coming into the country. So, and then you have Jessica Alba, who is she's Mexican, but she happens to work for the immigration American, the U.S. immigration. So she's a government agent, law enforcement. And so she's in charge of actually getting illegals out of the country. So there's all these different elements to the film. And I think that, there's probably just maybe a little too much politics involved, because there's a very heavy message of, you know, I'm not even sure, like, are they trying to say that, illegal Mexican immigrants should be allowed into the country? Are they trying to say that it's okay to sneak them into the country? Or like, I wasn't really sure, like, what they're trying to say. Like, I understand part of it is they're trying to say that, you know, obviously that Mexican laborers work for cheap and therefore people can, you know, pay, you know, very little cost to use them. And they're trying to say that, like, you know, that area, those areas of the country are basically run on the backs of these Mexican day laborers. But what I wasn't sure, like, the political message, I felt like there was definitely a strong political message in this film. But after a while, it got, like, a little skewed. And I just was sort of like, what is this movie about after a while? Because I felt like it stopped being about, you know, the whole thing was supposed to be his storyline, what's going on with him. And then all of a sudden it was like, you kind of forgot about that. And it was all this other stuff. So I feel like that's part of where things went wrong. Like you kind of took the fun out of it a little bit.
Now, what did you think about this compared to Piranha 3D? Because I know you love Piranha 3D, and this is the exact same type of movie where it's that ironic type of bad movie where they know they're making a bad movie and they're doing it on purpose. So if you try to say, okay, you made a bad movie, they're like, no, we meant it to be a bad movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, to me, bad movie is sort of like you said, where you see things that look like mistakes or people kind of the acting isn't that great and they're purposefully acting like Lindsay Lohan's character at the end, she kind of acts a little, you know, when she comes out in the nun's outfit, you know, like that's supposed to be melodramatic, like all the melodramatic acting, it's like the overacting. And so they could say, well, we did that on purpose because it's like, you know, parody kind of thing. But I don't feel that the whole movie, I actually don't feel that the movie was B movie enough to be considered a bad movie on purpose. Mm-hmm. Like Piranha 3D. Like, I feel like they knew exactly what they were making fun of. They knew exactly what they were going for. And in this movie, I feel like they almost made this movie a little too well to, Like, I think they put a little too much into the all those plots that we were talking about, mm-hmm. all the different plots. Like, I think that's where they went wrong. Like, they didn't keep it simple at all.
Yeah.
So, you know what I thought was funny? One of the best parts. Actually, I think one of the best parts of the movie were when they go to, when he shows up at Jeff Fahey's house, mm-hmm. and the security detail, they're outside and they're talking. Remember, he shows up with the garden tools,
yes.
and they're just like, "Oh, who are you?" And he's like, "I'm the gardener." And they're like, "Okay, go on in." And then as he's going in, they're like, "You ever notice how, you know, like, if it's a Mexican with tools, we just believe them. We just let them go in." And then, like, after that, there's that whole sequence where he fights them, and then later on he comes back for them. And I thought it was really funny that those people are the only ones that he treats differently than everyone else he encounters. Like, I thought that was pretty cool. And I thought it was funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was.
There was a lot of laughs to be had. The whole movie, I thought, had some great laughs in it. And the over-the-top violence is fun. It almost feels like a video game to me, though. And after a while, do you think that, well, you already mentioned that after a while, the gratuitous violence, it gets old, it gets worn out, and that,
yeah.
like we said, that probably would have benefited from a shorter running time.
Definitely. Yeah, I think if they would have cut it down to 85, 90 minutes, and I think it would have just flowed a lot better, and I definitely don't think we'd be like, oh, too much violence, you know, because it would probably be just enough.
Yeah, there was another movie similar to this that came out recently, Black Dynamite. It's that same type of, that's almost a, it's a parody of the blaxploitation genre.
Right.
But I haven't got a chance to see that. Have you seen Black Dynamite yet?
No, I haven't seen it either.
I've heard really good things about it, but I just, I have not had a chance to check it out yet. So after seeing Machete, and like I said, I enjoyed this movie, I enjoyed Piranha 3D, and I enjoy this style of movie. I'm really excited to watch Black Dynamite now.
Did you notice, too, in the beginning of the film when they're in Mexico, the quality of the film looks different than the rest of it? Like,
oh, yeah, they added that,
yeah.
the scratching. And
right, and the pops mm-hmm. and everything. But they only did it for that opening sequence. They didn't do it for the rest of the film. Like, if you look at Planet Terror, that too is supposed to be like a, you know, like a callback to Grindhouse type mm-hmm. movie. So the entire movie has like the quality of the film itself. Like, there's pops, there's scratches, there's changes in the lighting of it and everything. And they did it for the whole movie, but in this movie they didn't. They only made that opening scene. So I wasn't sure why, though.
Yeah, I thought the whole movie, when I saw that opening scene, I thought the whole movie was going to be like that, but that was an interesting choice, and
yeah.
once the Blu-ray/DVD comes out, I'll be listening to the commentary to see what Robert Rodriguez gives as his reasoning for that.
Well, I'd like to know why you would get this movie on Blu-ray.
On Blu-ray? Because it looks good, Eve. Why would you not?
Did you watch Planet Terror on Blu-ray?
Yeah, and that's a good transition if you want to talk about the other movies of Robert Rodriguez.
Yeah, yeah, let's get to it.
I rented on Blu-ray Planet Terror and Death Proof, but that's not a Robert Rodriguez-directed film. The Planet Terror Blu-ray actually has a feature where you can turn off the scratches and the pops, and that movie looks really good without the scratches and the pops. Like, he shot it very well, and it looks great on Blu-ray. So I'm sure Machete is going to look great on Blu-ray as well, Eve. I know you don't like looking at things that are nice, but I do.
No. My point is that if it's meant to look grainy and scratchy and old, then I kind of, that's how I want to see it's meant to look.
No.
But I mean, I do like the fact that there's an option, though. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because if I had known that, I think I would probably watch it both ways, too. Just because, you know, why not? If it's available, I'd like to see both.
I didn't watch the whole thing with the scratches off because I thought it was made to be with the scratches. So that's the way that I watched it. But I just to see what it looked like. And like I said, it looked amazing. Like, I was surprised how good it looked. But that's the thing with Robert Rodriguez. As I was going through his previous films, there was a point where he switched his style of filmmaking and the equipment that he used. It was right after the first Spy Kids. He was strictly shooting on film, 35 millimeter up to that point. But I was listening to the commentary on Spy Kids 2, I think it was. It was either 2 or 1 or 2 I was listening to the commentary. No, it was 2, I'm sorry, because there was no commentary for the first Spy Kids. But he was saying, as he was mixing the sound at Skywalker Ranch for the first Spy Kids, he became fascinated with the digital cameras that Lucas was using on Episode 2. And so they let him... He actually talked to Rick McCollum, the producer of the Star Wars trilogy, and they let him test out the cameras and take it home and use, you know, do test footage on it. So he became fascinated with digital filmmaking, and ever since then he said he's never going back to 35 millimeter. So everything he's shot since Spy Kids 2, or I'm sorry, everything since Once Upon a Time in Mexico has been in HD digital cameras. And he talks about in the commentary just all the advantages that digital filmmaking has. And as a filmmaker, he excites me as a filmmaker. As we get through all of his movies, I think what you'll come to find out is I'm not the biggest fan of him as a writer or necessarily as a director, but I find the techniques that he does very fascinating. And I normally, when there's a commentary, I'll just play the very first part of it just to kind of get a sense for what the director is talking about and see if I'll be interested in it and just to hear the director's voice a lot of times.
Yeah.
But with Spy Kids 2, I turned it on thinking I was going to watch like 5 minutes of it. Next thing I knew, the movie was over. I had watched the entire commentary and he didn't even talk about the movie. The entire commentary was just about filmmaking. So that was one of the most fascinating commentaries I've ever listened to. And I would definitely recommend anyone who's interested in filmmaking to check that out. Plus, he does on each one of his DVDs, with the exception of, I think it was Once Upon a Time in Mexico, I think doesn't have it. But every other DVD I've seen that he's done has a 10-minute film school. And he just goes through, it's about 10 minutes. I think there's only one of them went over 10 minutes. It was like, there was one that was like 13 or 14 minutes. But each one of them just goes through all the different effects that he did in the movie, and he just talks about how to make films on a low budget. And so that's really interesting to me to see how he does that. And also, it's also fascinating to me that he does something where he could spend more money. It's not like the studios are saying you have to come in on a shoestring budget, but he feels like when you have to make creative decisions because of the budget, it allows your creativity to open up and you can just be a more creative filmmaker. And he just has a lot more fun doing the lower budget movies, and he's saving the studio's money, and therefore they're saying, okay, you can do whatever you want as long as you make as much money as you do and you don't spend as much money, then we're going to give you total creative freedom. So I find that very interesting.
Yeah, he's a very smart filmmaker. He is a very creative filmmaker. And I find that when I'm watching his movies, no matter what they're about, I mean, I enjoy them because I enjoy his process and I enjoy the end result of it. And I feel like, you know, if another director had been on the film, I might not have been as interested in the actual story itself or things like that. But I do like that he... you know, like you said, it's like he chooses to go lower budget because he's forcing himself to be creative instead of just saying, let's throw money at it, let's throw some CGI on it, let's, you know, stuff like that, and then you have things that aren't as interesting. And I think that's what makes, you know, let's say all these movies that we like, when it's the first movie and it's made on a low budget and we watch it and you land up really liking it a lot. And then, like, let's say the second movie, they're like, okay, that first movie made a lot of money, let's throw like a lot of money at this second movie. It tends to get over the top. It tends to get, you know, too much CGI and things like that. And it's like really good when you have like a smart, creative filmmaker and you get to see like what's in his brain, what he could come up with very little money, very little resources. So I mean, that's a good thing to bring up with his first in the Mexico trilogy. He did El Mariachi, mm-hmm. and I think that was he did that movie on a $7,000 budget.
Yeah, and then right after that, he did a book called Rebel Without a Film Crew, and he talked about kind of the ways of making a Hollywood movie for $7,000 and different things like that. And most of the budget on that was the film. The cost of the film, then the cost of transferring it, because he filmed it on 16mm, and then they ended up transferring it to 35mm. So a lot of the budget was just on the film alone. So I'd be interested to see how much, without the film cost, how much it actually cost besides that.
And he also does a lot of the work himself. He'll do the music, he'll do the editing, he'll do the sound editing. I mean, he's everywhere. He's all over the place. On his films are truly a representation of him and what he can create. So I guess that's another way to keep the budget down when you know your hand is in everything. You know, you can cut costs everywhere. But I really enjoyed that El Mariachi. I know we both actually just saw it for the first time this week, right? It's on Netflix Instant, but is it ending soon? Was that one of the movies
it's October 1st. It's not going to be on Instant anymore. I had actually seen it, believe it or not, in high school. I took a Spanish class, and one of the days they just played that movie. That was our whole class. They were like, yeah, we don't want to teach you anything today, so here's El Mariachi. And nice. So we watched it without subtitles, and I had no idea what was going on. So I think I went to sleep. I remember kind of the outline of what happened. So now I know you watched it on Netflix Watch Instant, which has the English dub.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there is no actual subtitles. So I rented the DVD that had one side, it had El Mariachi, the other side, it had Desperado. Mm-hmm. So I watched it with the English subtitles and the actual Spanish language track, which I think I took a look at the Netflix one that you watched, and I'm going to say the Spanish one is the superior version.
Well, I typically don't, if I have a choice, I don't pick a dubbed version of a film. I always pick the language of the film and then with the subtitles. I never pick a dub, but that was all that was available to me this week on Netflix. So I watched it, and I actually got a kick out of it, mainly because I, you know, knew going in this is a low budget film. Mm-hmm. It's Robert Rodriguez, and so, you know, I don't know, it kind of fit. It almost fit in the sense, you know what I mean? Like in the style of the film, it almost fit to have the dub in it. Yeah, it made it a little more humorous, and, you know, because it does have, like, humorous parts in it. Mm-hmm. So, but I definitely want to go back now and watch the other version.
Yeah, and it's amazing to me. He made El Mariachi when he was 23 years old. That was the same age. I saw there was a trailer for it on one of the discs, and they were advertising, last year we brought you John Singleton, and he was 23 years old, and his debut, Boys in the Hood. Now we bring you another 23-year-old, Robert Rodriguez. So I thought that was kind of interesting. But yeah, for a debut film and for a film made on a $7,000 budget, I think it's pretty remarkable what he was able to accomplish. And also that he lets you in as a filmmaker and gives you the secrets and the techniques that he used. He wants everyone to be a better filmmaker, and he's not someone who, I think, like a magician would say, we don't want to reveal our tricks and we don't want anyone else to know how we did it. He doesn't take that approach. He on each one of his DVDs gives you all of these special features, the commentaries, all of the things. He gives you the actual techniques and the ways that he did it, which I find just fascinating, which I follow podcasts and certain things just because I'm interested in filmmaking and how it's done. So he was doing these things way before there were podcasts and there were websites about filmmaking and different things like that. So I find that interesting as well.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about this Mexico trilogy. So the first film, it's supposed to be about a very young aspiring mariachi player, right? And he wants to, he goes to, I don't know why he was going to another town. I guess he was going from town to town looking for work. And he shows up in this one town, and the character actually narrates the film. So he says, you know, I thought this was going to be another day where I just show up looking for work, and it turned out to be completely opposite. My life turned upside down. And so he goes into this town, and he comes with basically nothing but his guitar case in hand, and he's looking for work, but it turns out at the same time there's like a prison break, and this guy comes, you know, his signature thing is that he walks around with a guitar with weapons in it. And so the mariachi gets mistaken for the assassin type character. And so through the whole film, he's basically running from these drug lords who think that he is the guy who broke out of prison.
Mm.
So, it's very violent. Let's just get that out of the way. It's a very violent film. A lot of machine gun fire, and basically the whole trilogy did a lot of gun violence in it. But
and I was watching the machine gun real quick to talk about that. Mm-hmm. He's mentioned on the 10-minute film school. He borrowed two guns from the local police, and then the rest of the guns are all water guns. But the wow. actual guns themselves, once they put the blanks in them, they could only fire once. So anytime you saw like a machine gun firing multiple shots, that was just an editing trick. So,
wow.
Yeah, I found that pretty amazing.
That is amazing. Now that you say that, that's pretty amazing.
That's how good the filmmaking is. You never notice any of that.
Nope.
Like normally...
Like we were saying about bad movies. Yeah. Like normally in a bad movie, you would notice things like that. And that's what makes... He's making B-movies, but they're really not. They're like top-notch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's... I would say that is the best-made $7,000 budget yep. movie ever. And it it grossed $2 million at the box office.
Did it?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's pretty good. Well, now you know, like you said, the studios are like, all right, whatever you want to do. Mm-hmm. Because he knows how to make money for them without selling out. That's another big issue. You know, he's not selling out, man. He's doing what he wants to do, and he's doing it creatively. And, you know, you can't call the guy a sellout. So,
yeah,
you know, you gotta pull for him because he's a great filmmaker.
And it won multiple international awards, and El Mariachi is what gained that's what put Robert Rodriguez on the map, and that's where all of his fame came from. And then he just continued to go on and make just movie after movie. The Mexico trilogy, it's also called the Mariachi trilogy. Mm. I wanted to take a look at that as a whole, instead of just movie by movie. I think we can just look at that whole trilogy as a whole. I think I like El Mariachi the best out of all three movies.
Mm-hmm. I think I like Desperado the best. Because I really liked El Mariachi. I did. But as far as I think a movie that I can watch over and over again, and I've watched Desperado a lot of times. Like, first of all, it was the movie that pretty much introduced Antonio Banderas to U.S. audiences, right?
And Selma Hayek.
Right, and Selma Hayek. Mm-hmm. I forgot about her, right?
Yeah, this was her first American movie. And this is something Robert Rodriguez, again, he was talking about this on the commentary or on one of the special features. There hadn't been a Mexican leading lady since the 1940s. And he specifically wrote the role for Selma Hayek because she's a Mexican and this is a Mexican girl. The studio originally wanted a blonde to play the role.
Really?
Yeah. But I thought, actually, I would say I'm not the biggest Selma Hayek fan because a lot of the times, and this happens to me with Penelope Cruz too, it's not really a fault of her acting, but her accent is so thick. It's a lot of times it's hard for me to understand what she's saying.
It's distracting, yeah.
And I feel like she's not, sometimes you feel like when someone has that type of accent, it's a different, almost like they feel like they have a lower intelligence level sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I know that's not the case, but at the same time, it just feels like when someone doesn't have a mastery of the English language, you feel like their education level is lower just right. because of that. But Selma Hayek, I think this is probably my favorite role that she ever did.
It's definitely my favorite role of hers. And also, it's interesting you bring up the accent thing, because in this film, she's supposed to be Mexican in Mexico, right? Yet, I didn't think her accent was really that strong.
Hmm.
And now I feel like her accent seems stronger to me.
Yeah, that's...
Nowadays.
Yeah,
like, she's like... Mm-hmm. Feeding into it,
yeah.
Like, yes, this is my accent, and mm-hmm. now I'm going to exaggerate it.
Yeah, and you could see that even in Spy Kids, where she was in the third Spy Kids movie, and I could barely understand what she was saying, but in this movie, I didn't notice it. In Desperado, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird how she did that.
Right, yeah. So I feel like it's become part of her, like, it's her thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, okay, she's Mexican, and she had this accent, and, you know, it was sexy in Desperado, so now it's, like, every film she's in, she has to overdo it. Like, remember that one where she was in with Matthew Perry?
Oh, yeah.
Where mm-hmm. they were married or getting married or something like
mm-hmm.
that? Yeah, you can't understand a word she's saying in that movie. Like, it's like she's so exaggerating the accent.
Yeah.
So yeah, I agree. But in this movie, I thought she was really good, and I really like. Typically, I'm not a big fan of her either, like because of the overacting and the mm-hmm. over enunciating that she does. And but in this movie, I liked her when I first saw the movie, and then I still like her in it now. And I think Antonio Banderas too. Like, I mean, his accent is pretty thick too, but
yeah.
I don't feel the same way about him, although he does the same thing in certain movies where he exaggerates his accent.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. but in this one he didn't, and it's kind of ironic because they're supposed to be in Mexico in this movie. Mexicans in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And in the third film I felt like it was very different as far as tone. I felt like it was a much bigger production. I felt that it was, you know, like the ensemble is bigger and there's a lot more to follow. It's not just about a man seeking revenge. It's, you know, all the, I'll be honest with you. Once upon a time in Mexico, I got a little lost there for a while because there were so many different people being underhanded. And I kind of was like, who's on what team and what is their motivation? I wasn't even sure what their motivation was for half the things they were doing. And the problem with this trilogy is that it doesn't like really follow. Like, it doesn't perfectly follow as sequels, because what happens at the end of El Mariachi it's like different from what the beginning of Desperado.
Yeah, it's a weird trilogy. I've never seen a trilogy like this where I could even say that you can watch any of these movies individually and you don't really need to see any other ones. And Desperado, what I really like about it is you see right from the get-go the difference between the $7,000 budget and the $7 million budget.
Right.
Just right away, the first shot of the movie, it's kind of amazing to see that. But with Desperado, I enjoyed it, but I almost felt like it wasn't necessary. I felt that way definitely with Once Upon a Time in Mexico. But with Desperado, there were things, and we had this discussion before. Somebody had told me previously, I hadn't seen Desperado in a long time. I remember renting it, but previously somebody had told me that Desperado was a remake of El Mariachi, and it's not a full remake, but there are a lot of similar themes to it, and there are a lot of scenes that are similar. So it's almost like a halfway remake. Or
I think in this case you could get away with it, mainly because one was a different language, one was a Spanish language film, and then this one was, you know, obviously an English language film. And so I feel like, okay, from the first movie to the second movie, you can kind of get away with that. It's like, okay, we'll put a new actor, right? They got a whole new actor to play the lead. Mm-hmm. And
the original actor appears in both Desperado and Once Upon a Time in Mexico.
Yeah, he plays El Mariachi's, like, one of his friends mm-hmm. that are along for the mission.
Oh, he's in Machete also.
Yeah, I did see him. Mm-hmm.
And he's in Planet Terror as well.
Is he?
Yeah, he plays one of the sheriffs.
Oh, yeah, I did see him. Okay.
Yeah.
So So I feel like you could get away with that and get away with it enough to not confuse audiences. Because mm-hmm. if you watch the first movie and you're like, okay, and then you see, and you go, all right, this is like, you know, now they changed it for American audiences. And it's really not that much different. Like you said, there's a lot of similar things that happen. So you could say like, oh, they're making the same movie again, but it's not exactly the same, mm-hmm. you know, because the character in the first movie is an innocent person who has no experience with anything. But in the second movie, he comes back, and obviously he's now this, you know, he can wield all these weapons, and he can jump and run and, like, do all, like, he's like an action hero. Like, and it is an over-the-top action hero, too. It's like Die Hard 4 quality, right? Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the preposterousness of it all, yeah. right? Mm-hmm. And, but in the third film, then I got to the point where I was like, look, didn't we already get revenge? Like, each film, I feel like he already got the revenge.
Yeah, I felt like
that's what got confusing. Mm-hmm.
I felt like the third one was very unnecessary. And the third one, the Mariachi character is a background character mm-hmm. in his own movie. And Robert Rodriguez said that he wanted it that way, and he wanted it to be like the good, the bad, and the ugly of the trilogy. Mm. But I don't think that necessarily worked for Once Upon a Time in Mexico. They advertised Selma Hayek on the box and just her name, and she's barely in the movie.
And when she is, it's a flashback.
Yeah, the whole movie, yeah. I don't even think she has a... Oh, yeah, she does have a line. I'm
she
sorry.
Does. She does talk, yeah.
It's either a flashback or it's a dream.
Yeah.
Because there's mm-hmm. that sequence, which I watched the trailer on the DVD, and from the trailer, you would think Selma Hayek was all through this movie just because she was in that one scene that was in the trailer.
Right.
But, yeah, there was a lot of things that confused me about Once Upon a Time in Mexico. It was made 8 years after Desperado. They came back to it. Why did they come back to it?
I don't know. What was happening, Justin? Because I don't know. Like, Johnny Depp's character, I like how he acted. Like, I like the character, and I like how Johnny Depp played him. And there was a lot of good things about that character. But what was going on with him? What was he doing?
Yeah, I have no idea. I don't know anything that was going on in the movie, but I enjoyed him the most. I'll say,
yeah, me too.
If the one thing I could take away from Once Upon a Time in Mexico, well, the two things I'll take away, Eva Mendes was looking good, and Johnny Depp, I liked him. But everything else about the movie, I know there's a lot of fans of that movie. I talked to people on Twitter. My cousin was just telling me how much she loved that movie, but she's just a big Johnny Depp fan.
You know, I saw that movie when it came out in the theaters. What year was that? 96?
Which one?
Once Upon a Time in Mexico?
That was 2003.
2003. Okay, mm-hmm. So I remember going to see it, and I remember I liked it, right? I remember coming out and be like, oh, yeah, I liked it, whatever. Then, so if you would have asked me last week, oh, what'd you think of that movie? I would have said, oh, yeah, I really liked it. Great movie, right? Well, I revisited it this week. And I go, what the hell? Why did I like this movie so much that first time? And I think it was because Johnny Depp was so good in that movie. Like, they could have just gotten rid of everyone and just made it about him, and it would have been a great movie, because he really, you know, like, he stole the show. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what it probably was. I probably was like, yeah, you know, Johnny Depp blew me away. He's great. And also that scene where he's laying out in the street and his eyes sockets are bleeding. Like, mm-hmm. I think that's the one thing about that movie I always remembered. It left like a very deep impression on me. And so I think that's part of it. But revisiting it this week, I definitely was like, what the hell is going on with this movie? And not only that, why did they hire all Hispanic actors, right? Johnny Depp wasn't playing, his character was American, so that's fine. Like, he mm-hmm. wasn't playing anybody Hispanic. Everyone else was supposed to be Hispanic. So why did they cast Willem Dafoe?
I have no idea, except for to do his Scarface accent, which he lost me. I love Willem Dafoe, but I was thinking about, he's made some bad choices in his career. I loved him as Osborn in Spider-Man and some other things as well, but He was not right for this role.
No. I mean, I didn't understand why he was cast when, I mean, it kind of goes against, you know, I think everything that Robert Rodriguez has done. It's like, it kind of went against it to hire him. And then, of course, I was like, what's his deal? Why is he in this movie? Why is he getting reconstructive surgery? Who's mad at him? Why is El Mariachi, who is he killing this time? I thought he killed everybody already. Who is he killing now? I mean, I don't understand. Like, in the first movie, the guy who perpetrated the harm against him and his girlfriend, you know who he is. It's that one person, right? Okay, Justin, I come and I shoot your friend. Okay, so you know I shot your friend and I meant to because it was my thing. No one hired me to do it. I did it. Then in the second movie, there's another person. Now we got to go kill him. And I'm like, why? That person had nothing to do with it. But again, you were like, okay, it's the American version. They changed up the story. Okay, fine. No big deal, right? This one, again, now he's after Willem Dafoe's character, and I have no idea why.
Yeah, everything about the Once Upon a Time in Mexico, it was just escalating the previous movie. It just kept building and building and building. Things like that where the plot was the same, but it just kept building and building. The mariachi's superpowers built each movie, they got bigger and bigger. Where the first one, he's just a normal guy. He's got some guns, although he survives a bunch of bullet wounds. But then in the second one, he gets a little tougher. He gets a little faster.
You know, over time, he went and he trained somewhere like Rocky. And, right? You could say, he learned to shoot guns and throw knives and do somersaults. And, you know, I mean, for the purpose of filmmaking, you could say that, right? You could say he even found a mentor who karate kidded him, right? You could say all those things. But in the third film, he could practically fly in the third film.
He was crawling up the wall like Spider-Man in one scene. He jumped over this balcony. It was like five stories up, it looked like. He landed on his feet like a cat, and he got up and walked away. Oh, yeah, I do that all the time.
I mean, at least in the second movie where they had to jump the rooftops, it looked like they almost busted their asses, right? They, like, landed on their side, and they were tumbling all over the place, and they were limping, right? Not in this movie. Not only that, their weapons got more, like, they had rocket launchers, right? I'm like, where? All right. And in every movie, you know he has no money, right?
Yeah.
In every film, he has no money. Everywhere they go, he's practically eating garbage off the street. He has no money. Where is he getting all the money for the weapons and, like, the bullets and all that? You know, where are they buying these rocket launchers? Do you have the money right now, Justin, to go buy a rocket launcher?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the rocket to go in the rocket launcher.
Yeah.
Do you have that kind of money? Because I don't.
I made it on my mariachi budget, my paycheck, yeah.
So that, I mean, all right, fine. You have to suspend the disbelief for that, but that's why I'm saying in the third movie, now you're getting crazy. Now you have three guys who have no money and know nothing. And they have, not only do they have these weapons, but they have them in a way where they're hidden in the guitar cases and they can use them right through the guitar. They don't even have to take them out. That's pretty intricate, my friend.
Yeah.
Pretty intricate. But so maybe anyone out here, like, listening to us right now, if you can explain Once Upon a Time in Mexico to us, like, you don't even have to explain how people survive all these bullet wounds or how they survive jumps over balcony. Forget it. We're fine with that. We know it's the magic of movie making, okay? But if you could tell us what the plot is, like, why are people doing what they're doing, we would greatly appreciate it. You could email us at flicksofdoom@gmail.com, that's flicks with an X, and just title it, you know, Once Upon a Time in Mexico, and then explain the movie to us, please. And actually, if you do, we'll read it on our next episode. How about that? We'll read your explanation on our next episode.
Yeah, please do, please. Danny Trejo appeared again, as I said, in the movie, even though he died in the second one, but he came back. He was playing a different character.
A different character, yeah.
Cheech Marin came back.
I kind of like that, though. I like that in his movies, you get to see those same characters, the same actors, but playing different characters, and it's like, okay, you know what I mean? And I also like that it's not even just in the same trilogy, but like in his movies themselves. Like if you look at Planet Terror, you'll see a lot of the same characters from different movies. I kind of like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what else did you watch besides this Mexico trilogy?
Well, before we go to the other films, this is a little interesting fact if you're into box office. Once Upon a Time in Mexico holds the box office record for the most improved second sequel of all time, making 122% more than Desperado.
Wow.
Where Desperado, like I said, was a $7 million budget and it made $25 million. Once Upon a Time in Mexico was a $29 million budget and it made $98
million. Wow. That's pretty good.
And like I said, it was also the first film that he shot in HD, and he has not looked back since then. The other movies I watched, another trilogy, was the Spy Kids trilogy. Now, this is another side of Robert Rodriguez where you have Machete and Planet Terror, these ultra-violent, gratuitous nudity, all of these very adult type of things in a film. He also has the family-friendly franchise of Spy Kids. He also did Shark Boy and Lava Girl. And then there was a movie called Shorts that he did. All of these, you would not think this is the same guy making these movies. And
right.
Actually, Danny Trejo first played a character named Machete in the first Spy Kids movie, working again with Antonio Banderas and a bunch of other people. That Cheech Marin was in the Spy Kids trilogy. You haven't seen these movies, right?
No, I have. I've seen, I saw a little bit of the first movie, and then I saw a little bit of the third movie, but no, I've never seen them in their entirety.
The thing I'll say about the Spy Kids movies, they're nice, fun entertainment for the family and for kids. I don't think they're like Pixar movies where you can get something out of them, no matter what your age. I think they're very much aimed at kids, and as an adult watching it, I didn't enjoy the story or the actual movie itself because it's about two kids. This is very unrealistic to me. It's about two kids who become spies, and they look like they're 9 years old, and any villain who's worth $2 would defeat these kids within 2 seconds. There's no way these kids would be international spies. It's kind of ridiculous. But anyways, that's the whole concept. Their parents get kidnapped, and then they have to be the spies.
Right.
I was telling you off mic, if I was a kid, this would be my favorite movie of all time if I was a kid. Just getting to use all of these different gadgets, which I've always been big into technology and gadgets. So as a kid, I loved Inspector Gadget or anything that involved any type of technology, especially spy gadgets. I was always ordering out of the back of comic books like 3D glasses and spy watches and things like that. So as a kid, I bet I would have loved this film. But as an adult, it's just kind of disposable entertainment for me. Nothing.
Well, I watched the Shark Boy and Lava Girl, and I felt that way about that film. I mean, I really think you have to be like a young kid, the same kid, the same age as the kids in the film, and you will love it because it's like your little adventure. I don't think that, again, I agree with you. I don't think it's like the Pixar films. I think it's like really, really aimed for kids, and like you really, I don't ever foresee myself watching Shark Boy and Lava Girl ever again.
Yeah, I won't either. I couldn't even get through all of Shark Boy and Lava Girl because after a while I said, okay, I know what the rest of the film is going to be like. I really don't need to see this whole thing. I'll say the Spy Kids films are more enjoyable than Shark Boy and Lava Girl. So if you don't go into Spy Kids thinking it's going to be like that, because I think Shark Boy and Lava Girl was even a younger audience because I don't know if you know the behind the scenes about that, but his son came up with the idea.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
And you can definitely tell because that is a story that like a 5-year-old would come up with.
Right.
Which is.
Yeah, it was very much like very, very juvenile. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was almost like as if a young child was telling you the story.
Yeah.
Right? Like, if you went up to a little kid and they were like, I have a story I'm going to tell you I made up, and that would be the story. Definitely.
And so his son, which he has some weird names for his kid.
Yeah, it's like Rocket.
Yeah, and Racer.
Racer
Rodriguez and Rocket Rodriguez. But Racer, which his sons are in the film. They play the young shark boy.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And so that's another interesting thing you'll see on the, if you watch the commentary or the special features, which both the Spy Kids and the Shark Boy and Lava Girl, I had a much more interesting time seeing the making of
right.
and how they made it, because both of or all three of those movies use a lot of green screen and CGI, and it's a very interesting way that he makes it. You can tell he's very George Lucas inspired
right.
in his ways, and there are
now,
certain
he made these films, though I thought he made them because he wanted to make films that his children could see. Right, it's like because he makes these movies that are violent and graphic, right, I thought he was like, okay, now I'm gonna turn my attention to making these films that my kids can watch.
Yeah,
right, like mm-hmm. that was what inspired him to do those.
Yeah, I didn't hear that, but that sounds very plausible to me. Mm-hmm. But like I said, the first Spy Kids, he shot it on regular 35mm film, and he had a number of problems that he had on the film, and he ended up for Spy Kids 2 and 3 going digital, and it saved him. He said it was easier to light the film, it was easier to edit the film, which that's another thing. He wears so many hats on all of these productions. Like you talked about earlier, he did the music, he's the director, he's the editor, he's a cinematographer, he's the writer. He does pretty much everything on the movie. And so he was, as a director and an editor, since he wears both of those hats, he's able to have a clear vision for what he wants when he's shooting the film. And oh, you know what another thing was? The Spy Kids 2, instead of saying a Robert Rodriguez film, it says a digital file, because it's
really?
not he's not shooting it on film anymore. And I noticed afterwards he would put Robert Rodriguez flick, and he wouldn't use the word film anymore. And he talked about that in the commentary.
I did see that. I think it said that on one of the movies I just watched. It said a Robert Rodriguez flick mm-hmm. on it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So one of the things that I first noticed with Spy Kids was the amount of celebrity or big name cameos. And that is persistent throughout all of his movies. But when I started this Robert Rodriguez marathon that I've been on the last week, Spy Kids was the first thing that I started watching. So that was the first thing that I noticed. Antonio Banderas and Carla Gugino were the two parents. They had Alan Cumming, Terry Hatcher, Cheech Marin, Danny Trejo, Robert Patrick, Tony Shalhoub. All of them were in the first Spy Kids movie, and then they all came back for all three of the movies. And he said the reason he's able to get all of these actors is because he films just their parts and then goes on to the next scene. So each person will only come in for like a day or 2 days of shooting, and they'll be done with the movie. So he said a lot of actors like doing that, and they like working for him. So
if two actors are in a scene together, they won't even shoot the scene together?
Yeah, a lot of times they're not in the... He'll digitally add them in together. Oh. So that was interesting. Like, there's a scene in Spy Kids 3 where all these people come together and they put their hands in a huddle, and it's, you know, 1, 2, 3, go. Nobody was in the same... Like, he filmed every single person separately, and there was like 10 people, I think, in the shot. So as the Spy Kids movies went along, they just got more and more digital and less about story. And by the third movie, I think it just went way... He almost like Machete, I think, where he just got too much... He had too much freedom. In the third Spy Kids movie, there was very little plot, and it was all about being inside of a video game. So everything was about...
And it was 3D,
yeah,
too.
Everything was about 3D, and it was about what levels of the video game. And the story took a back seat, and I think that the third movie is the worst of the Spy Kids movies, because it just... It was all about green screen, and the whole movie was shot on green screen, so there was nothing real.
Right.
And it was like... It was just very disappointing to me after... I enjoyed the first two Spy Kids, like I said, for what they were. But the third one was just, it was like Sharkboy and Lava Girl. It was almost unwatchable to me.
Right.
And the third one, although did have Sylvester Stallone in one of the funniest parts, which I told you, I think you should watch it just for the Sylvester Stallone part, because he plays like five different characters. And they're all on the screen at the same time. So that was.
I think that's what I saw. I saw like some parts with him. That's how come I knew what you were talking about.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. It was Spy Kids 3D that said a Robert Rodriguez digital file. That was the one that was.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So, like I said.
Are they actually doing another Spy Kids movie?
Yeah, there's another one coming out next year. So.
How old are these kids?
That's going to be interesting. I think they're. Well. The boy from Spy Kids was in Machete. He was the little white kid who was adopted by Mexicans, and he thought he was Mexican.
Oh, that's right.
So
okay.
That's how old he is. So he's pretty old now, and I'm sure she is too.
Yeah.
At this point, I'm not sure their exact ages. I could look it up, but I don't really feel like doing that right now.
Seeing him in Machete, he's definitely an adult.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Daryl like, Sabera you know, like, is his name.
He definitely, I mean, even if he's 18, I mean, you know, he's definitely not a spy kid. Who knows? Maybe it won't be those actors. Maybe they'll pass the torch or something.
Well, I think they are cast for the movie, and I think that's going to be interesting because 1, 2, and 3 were filmed back to back to back, 2001, 2002, 2003. So there wasn't really a lot of time passing in between, and the stories were kind of similar. I'm going to be interested to see the story now that they're older. I think it's going to open up a lot of new storytelling ideas and potential. So that's going to be interesting. In the second movie, that just you're going back to how many stars were in it. George Clooney is in a lot of them. Steve Buscemi, Mike Judge, Bill Paxton, Ricardo Montalban is in the second and third movies. And, oh, Salma Hayek, I said. Haley Joel Osment's little sister, Emily, is in the movies, and she looks exactly like him. Elijah Wood, and then when we went to Sharkboy and Lava Girl, there was Taylor Lautner, there was George Lopez, Kristen Davis.
He must be cringing when he looks back on that role, huh?
Well, they talked about how they were. He did it as a, you know, he was. They were good friends of each other, and they. I wonder about that when stars do things for kid movies. Do they even care? Just because. You know, a lot of times you just assume kids' movies are going to be bad. So
no, but I mean like Taylor Lautner.
Oh, Taylor Lautner?
Like, I mean like that. Let's put it this way. If I was him, I would rather you see me as the werewolf in Twilight.
Well, I was going to say, I don't think the Twilight movies are anything to say this is a great part of my resume. I was in the Twilight movies as an actor. I don't think Sharkboy and Lava Girl is any worse than Twilight series.
I disagree. Like, I have to say, if I was him, he has to sing in Sharkboy. Remember, he's like, dream, 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 dream. Remember?
Well, he has to take his shirt off half the time in Twilight. What's the difference?
Yeah, but so what? So what? He's got a great body. What? There's nothing to be embarrassed about. That's what I'm saying. Like, he doesn't have to be.
Yeah, but as an actor, taking your shirt off has nothing to do with your acting ability.
But I think I'm saying, like, I would definitely be more embarrassed if I was him.
I wouldn't.
His character in Sharkboy was like such a little brat and
Yeah, but he was a kid. Like, I wouldn't be embarrassed by anything I did as a kid. Like, if I walked, I mean, everybody pooped their pants as a kid. Like, when you're a kid, it doesn't matter. I would be much more embarrassed when you were a fully functioning adult and you're taking your shirt off.
Well,
and
then again, he was not an adult when he did the Twilight movies. He was still a teenager.
Okay, so. Well, a fully functioning teenager that knew exactly what he was doing and was not acting the greatest. I would be much more embarrassed for the Twilight series. Mm-hmm. But also in Sharkboy and Lava Girl, David Arquette and Kristen Davis from Sex and the City. And Robert Rodriguez likes to cast his family a lot in Planet Terror, in Death Proof, and we also saw in Machete, the twin nurses in Machete. Mm-hmm. I found out those are his nieces.
The crazy babysitting twins, right?
Yeah. And they had no experience. I guess he just liked them, and he decided to put them in the movies, which They do a great job at being crazy twins.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And yeah, every movie they're like a little crazy, right?
Yeah. So yeah. That again.
And they're shooting someone.
Yeah. That was interesting to see them. But he cast people multiple times in multiple movies. We talked about Jeff Fahey being in Machete, right, and Planet
Steve
Terror.
Steve Buscemi, too.
Yeah, Steve Buscemi. Rose McGowan was in a couple movies. And she was on both Grindhouse movies. She was in Planet Terror and Death Proof,
right, which
he just had a producing credit on Death Proof. Bruce Willis, he was in Sin City and he was in Planet Terror. And also Marley Shelton.
Mickey Rourke.
Yeah, Mickey Rourke was in Sin City. Marley Shelton was in Sin City. There was his son. Did you notice his son was in Planet Terror? We're kind of skipping ahead to Planet Terror here. Yeah, but
the little boy, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize that until I saw all of the things on Sharkboy and Lava Girl and all the different behind the scenes.
I also read something like where his son hasn't seen the movie yet.
Yeah,
like,
there's
at the time, like his son was in Planet Terror, but he wasn't able to see it because, you know.
Yeah, he hasn't at the time that Robert Rodriguez recorded the commentary, he said he hadn't told his son that he died in the movie because
Oh, right.
Yeah, because when he died, it was just a doll. So he wasn't there for any of that. He didn't see the doll. And Robert Rodriguez filmed an alternate ending where his son lived till the end.
Yeah. Right. You see him at the end in Mexico, right, with the turtle.
And they filmed him all throughout the entire movie running to each place with everybody.
Right.
But then he just decided it was better to just kill his son, which I thought that was funny.
But, that is kind of funny.
Yeah. So I guess just to wrap up, I enjoyed the Spy Kids movies, but they're not anything that I think adults would go crazy for. They're mostly about CGI and the technology, not great acting from either of the kids. And Antonio, actually, I will say the cool thing about Spy Kids is you see that Antonio Banderas can play drama, he can play action, he can play comedy, he can play all these different things, and he's great in all the different roles. So that was Spy Kids. Oh, let me give you, for you box office hounds out there real quick, the first Spy Kids had a $50 million budget and it made $147 million. The second one had a $38 million budget and it made $119 million. And then the third one had a $38 million budget and it made $197 million. Mm. So those Spy Kids movies, just the entire franchise was a big win for the studio.
Right.
So he did Sharkboy and Lava Girl, and then with Grindhouse, with Sin City, kind of got back to more adult fare. And I think Sin City is my favorite movie that he's done.
Really?
And I think
I think he did a great job on that, adapting it from Frank Miller's.
Well, I think it's the perfect movie for him because it was done, it's very heavily stylized, taking advantage of all of the digital technology that he loves to do, and also adapting it from an already existing source material. I don't think he had to do a lot of the brunt of the writing responsibilities, which I think for me, the job that he does that I like the least is his writing. I'm not a big fan of his writing abilities on his films. I think he's much better director, much better editor, much better just filmmaker in general. And I'd really like to see him do something that he didn't write.
Right.
Actually, he directed The Faculty, which he didn't write. But if I remember correctly, The Faculty is not a very good movie.
I did not see it, but it seemed like one of those typical PG-13 horror movies that I don't go for. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And that the only reason I watched it, I remember, is because I was a big Usher fan at the time.
Oh,
and
really?
I was like, oh, Usher's in a movie? Selma Hayek is in that. What do you know? I'm looking at the cast right now. Elijah Wood is in that, who is also in Spy Kids, and Josh Hartnett. So, I didn't know who Robert Rodriguez was at the time when he made that. But another one that was made on a $15 million budget, and it made $40 million. So he's had very few movies in his career that did not make money. Even Sharkboy and Lava Girl on a $50 million budget made $69 million.
All right.
And then, like we said, getting back to Sin City, I think everything that he... Sin City played to all of his strengths as a filmmaker, and Elijah Wood was in that one as well. So that, yeah. On a $40 million budget, it made $158
million. Wow. Now, in Sin City, he basically took panel for panel. Like, I don't... Did they even have to do storyboards on that film? Because they basically took panel for panel Frank Miller's graphic novels and put it up on the screen. I mean, it was really, that's what it was.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they used his comic as a storyboard.
Well, that's why he fought so hard for Frank Miller to get director credit. Mm-hmm. I don't think Frank Miller actually directed anything. I think that, but because...
Which I wish it would have remained that way after seeing The Spirit.
Yeah, pretty much. But, I mean, he definitely did justice. I mean, talk about... We've talked in previous episodes about comic book adaptations, right? And mm-hmm. I think we all had different, you know, ideas about them. But this is one where you could say he took it... I mean, like, he did not stray very far. I mean, I think there was only a few things that he changed, right? I mean, we didn't get a chance to rewatch it this week like we wanted to, but I think I recall that he didn't change much.
Yeah, right? He was very faithful to the comic. If any changes, I think this, Sin City and Watchmen are probably the two movies that I would say are the most faithful to the comic book.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I remember I hadn't read the graphic novels at the time and just being blown away by Sin City when I saw it in the theater.
Well, in a way, like, I was very familiar with the comics. I had read them. So, in a way, I felt like, right from the beginning, when I saw how faithful it was, I was like, well, I know everything that's going to happen because he's basically shooting panel by panel.
Mm-hmm.
But, actually, that didn't really bother me because I just thought it was so well made and the acting was really good. And I just thought it was really well done. And I typically don't. You know, I typically, I'm not big into, like, the green screen or what have you, but because he was trying to make it actually look like the comic book, like, it looked like the sketches from the comic book, so he did it with the green screen or whatever, and it came out amazing.
Yeah, I definitely think
that. And the girl that was in, now, I just remembered, was the girl from Sin City, the one with the swords, wasn't she in Machete? I think she was in it.
Yeah, like I said,
she was the girlfriend of Steven Seagal, I think.
Hmm.
I think that's the same actress. I gotta look that up.
Yeah, I think she was Devon Aoki. She was a model. She was in Fast and the Furious, one of the Fast and the Furious.
Oh, really?
That may or may not have been her, but I'd have to look it up again.
Okay, it looked like her.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that he reused in other things. Like we said, Bruce Willis, Carlo Gugino, Mickey Rourke. Yeah, there's a lot of people that...
Elijah Wood.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people that... Jessica Alba. So,
right, yeah, Jessica
Alba. He's reused a lot of people. Mickey Rourke was in Once Upon a Time in Mexico.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which we didn't mention.
But that's what I like, is that he can use the same actors, but you don't feel like they're the same characters.
Yeah.
You're not like, oh, here it is, same character. You know, like, you cast the same actor, and now they're going to play that same character again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you don't feel that way.
Danny Trejo's a good example of that, how his character from Spy Kids, totally different from his character in Machete, and different from his character in the Mexico or Mariachi trilogy.
Yeah.
So that's interesting to see. So yeah, I think we both enjoyed Sin City. We didn't get a chance to rewatch it, but I have the Blu-ray coming from Netflix, and it has a bunch of special features on it, so I'm going to check out that. Hopefully... listen to the commentary on there as well. Quentin Tarantino directed a segment of Sin City, which, that's another thing. If you talk about Robert Rodriguez, you have to talk about Quentin Tarantino, and they have a whole friendship that goes back to, I was listening to the commentary on Desperado, and Quentin Tarantino appears in that movie, and he originally, I guess, they met at a film festival, and Quentin Tarantino was Mr. Reservoir Dogs at that time, and mm-hmm. Robert Rodriguez was El Mariachi, and they just, I guess they kind of hit it off, and they've been friends ever since, and been dying to do a movie together, and then that brought us the Grindhouse collaboration, where each one of them wanted to take a double feature or a piece of the double feature like they used to see when they were growing up as kids. I don't know if they both live in Texas. Do you know where Tarantino lives?
No. Because
I know Robert Rodriguez, he's a big Texas guy and he films all of his movies in Texas. I'm not sure if Tarantino lives in Texas or not, but yeah, they both almost have a similar path to their careers, how they came up in movie making, although I think Tarantino's the much better writer. And
yeah, he can do dialogue, but it's very stylized, though. Like, yeah. You know, could Tarantino have written Spy Kids? No way. Right?
Yeah. And not all actors can speak his dialogue as well. But
no.
Yeah, that's maybe we'll save that for our Tarantino episode, which he is one of my favorite directors working today.
Yeah, me too.
But yeah, so they came together to collaborate on Grindhouse, the double feature. Quentin Tarantino did Death Proof, the second half of the feature, and Robert Rodriguez did Planet Terror, the first half of the feature, and I got a chance to rent both of them on Blu-ray, and as I said before in the episode, they looked spectacular on Blu-ray, and again, using actors that he had used before, Jeff Fahey, which he was great as the barbecue
Oh, that
guy.
Was so awesome. The whole time, he's not giving up that recipe.
And I loved it even more this time because when I saw it in the theater, I didn't know who he was. I'd never seen him before.
You never saw Lawnmower Man?
I've never seen him.
Every time I see him, I'm like, Lawnmower Man.
Yeah, I have yet to see that movie yet. But I'm kind of redundant there, but I've yet to see that movie. And now I've seen him, all I think about is Lapidus from Lost. Because he was great in that series. But now seeing him as this character, I loved. And seeing one of our favorites from the 80s, Michael Biehn, as sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
Which, for some reason, I did not recognize him when I saw it in the theater the first time. And he looks different now that he's older. But his voice is the exact same. So I don't know why I didn't recognize him. But this time I recognized him and I was like, yeah, Michael Biehn. Because I'm a huge Terminator fan. So seeing him again was cool. What did you think about Planet Terror?
I loved Planet Terror. When I went to see this in the theater, I think they played Planet Terror first.
Yeah.
Right? And I remember being like, I love it, I love it. And me and my husband, we both totally were like, I love it. This is such a great film because, you know, it has the whole kind of zombie like element and the whole military facility, and then there's the whole the human aspect where you see like the Texas barbecue guy and Rose McGowan at the go-go dancer with a heart and El Rey, who is probably like one of the best characters. I love him. You know what? I want to see the El Rey movie, okay? Because I love that's Freddie Rodriguez, right? And he was great. And so I loved all those characters. Everything, Josh Brolin, right? I mean, everyone was great in this movie. And then they went to Death Proof, and I did not love Death Proof. I felt like it was a long time to be sitting in the theater through two movies and four faux trailers, right? I felt like it was a lot to be sitting in the theater when you're just not used to doing that. Like, you're not used to going and seeing two complete films. They're not sequels or anything like that. So it's not like when you go to see, like, oh, I'm going to go see this trilogy of films all at once and you could sort of mentally prepare and it's the same style or what have you. These are completely different films. They have completely different paces. And so I feel like that's probably why it didn't do all that well in the theater. And I think it wasn't one of Tarantino's best movies. And I wish, looking back, I really wish they had – I bet you they would have done better separately. Like, each one would have done better separately, I think.
Internationally, they released them separately.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when you watch them on Blu-ray, and I'm sure it's like this on DVD as well, they are extended. Both of them have scenes that you did not see in the theater. But
yeah,
I did the same thing. I went back and rewatched both movies, and I had the same experience as you did. In the theater, I was a much bigger Planet Terror fan than I was of Death Proof. And when I watched it again on Blu-ray, I liked Death Proof a lot more, and I appreciated it much more. Now, I'm also coming at it at a different perspective because I'm a much bigger Tarantino fan now, and I know exactly how he writes and the way that he makes films. So that's one thing that you have to go into Death Proof realizing. And it's a much slower pace movie.
Yes.
There's a lot. But I think if you really let it marinate for a while, then you'll see that, as with all of his movies, the dialogue is fantastic in Death Proof. I think it's two different movies. The first one is like almost like a slasher film where Kurt Russell's character is stalking these women, and then there's a horrific violent scene in it, which I loved in the movie, and I really loved that first half. To me, in the theater, the second half of the movie was what I did not like, when it turns into an action chase car movie. Mm-hmm. And I still don't like it as much watching it again, but I appreciate it much more now. And that is one of the best car chase sequences I've seen in a movie. And the stunts are amazing in that movie.
Right.
They used no CG. It was all real cars. And Zoe Bell on the hood of the car for most of the chase scene. I love Zoe Bell as an actress, as a stunt person. So seeing her was really cool. But the thing, just not to talk too much about Death Proof, because we're on the Robert Rodriguez episode. But real quick, I just want to say, the thing that I loved about the first half was that, spoiler alert here, if you haven't seen Death Proof, skip ahead a little bit. But all the girls were annoying to me. So when they got killed, I was happy. I was like, yeah, get them, yeah.
And you know what? I felt the same exact way. I was like, just kill them all.
And they had these really cool death sequences. One of them flew out of the car. One of them, her leg got chopped off. And then the other character, Vanessa Ferlito, who I said reminded me of you, she got a car, the tire ran over her face and skinned it up. So that was cool. I really liked that. And then the second half, the girls, again, I found all of them annoying, except for Zoe Bell, who I love, like I said. I found all the girls annoying. Oh, and Ramona Flowers, I liked her as well.
But
we'll get it.
But she was like asleep through the whole movie. So,
she was barely in it, and they just left her in the last part.
That didn't make any sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyways, getting past that, I wanted those girls to die pretty much.
Right.
And when they didn't, I was upset. And also the way that it just ends at the very end, I was upset at that. So watching it again, I still have those problems. But like I said, I like the first part of the movie a lot more now, and the second part with the car chase and the stunts, I appreciate a lot more now. So I don't hate Death Proof as much as I did when I saw it in the theater. I like it a lot more now, but man, it's hard to say now. I think I like Planet Terror and Death Proof equally now, but I like Death Proof for different reasons than I like Planet Terror. And it is really weird to put them together on a double feature because they're so dissimilar.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that was supposed to be different was the fact that they were quote-unquote grindhouse movies. They're supposed to, you know, like, they were supposed to be low budget, low quality of the film itself. Like, you see the pops and the scratches. And that was another thing about Death Proof that annoyed me, is that I felt like it kept changing. Like, sometimes it was old and scratchy, and then sometimes it looked perfect. Well, so,
yeah, I noticed inconsistent. The whole first part of the movie, it was scratchy, but the second part, it was completely clean, which I didn't understand that.
I guess they were trying to be like, when you see a film, how it has different reels, so maybe he was trying to say, like, oh, that first reel was screwed up, and then the next ones are okay, but whatever. But yeah, it's like, because they were released together as Grindhouse, that was the name of the film. It was called Grindhouse. And so you were going to go, and you were going to see the two films and the four fake trailers, and that was the Grindhouse experience. And so in my mind, because that's how I went to see them, and like even leading up to the theatrical release, I knew it was coming, and I was like, oh wow, you know, like these two directors who I love, and I figured I would love it and it would be great. And I really didn't even know what to expect when I got there, and I definitely ended up loving Planet Terror, and I still do. I rewatched it actually this morning, and I love it. Like, there was no part of it that I felt like this is boring or I need to forward through or I don't care. I think it's a great film.
And
definitely.
Robert Rodriguez wrote Planet Terror. I'll say of the movies he's written, I think Planet Terror is the best written, or right. I should say best script out of all the movies that he's done, because I really love the storyline in Planet Terror.
Yeah, me too.
And I was a big fan of Planet Terror in the theaters, like I said, and another lost actor, Naveen Andrews.
Oh, yeah, he's in it.
I didn't know at the time.
Obsessed with balls.
And that part made me laugh in the theater, and it made me laugh when I watched it again.
I didn't understand why, when he was running away, he was scooping up the balls and putting it in his pocket. I did not understand. I'm like, okay, I understand you had the fascination previously, and that's your thing, and it makes people frightened, but like now your life is in danger, and you have to run. Why are you grabbing for the balls?
So. I love that. It just made me laugh. Actually, yeah. The difference between the theatrical and the extended was the theatrical was 80 minutes. The extended cut, which I watched on Blu-ray, was 105 minutes. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot that was added to it. And right. Yeah, I loved Josh Brolin, who when I saw in the theater, I wasn't as familiar with Josh Brolin as I am now. And I loved him in the movie. I loved all the actors. I would say with the exception of Stacey Ferguson, who
You
will know as Fergie. The Black Eyed Peas. I thought she was terrible.
She did good.
I did not like her in the movie at all. And
but I think she was supposed to be like the damsel.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
You know, whatever.
As we talked about earlier, being a movie that's supposed to be bad or a B movie type movie, I thought she was bad in a bad way, not bad in a good way. I did not like her at all in the movie.
Well, luckily she's hardly in it.
So. Yeah. So, well, spoiler alert, when she dies, I like that.
I like that. That's a no-brainer.
Yeah! Tom Savini was another one that was in.
Oh, yeah.
He was in this. He was in From Dusk Till Dawn. And he was in Machete, which when he showed up on screen on Machete, there was some guy behind me in my theater that, he screamed.
All right.
That was the only time he went crazy during the whole movie. So.
Oh, that's cool.
Interesting.
Well, the person behind me was actually the people behind me in the theater for Machete were a young couple. They looked like maybe they were, I don't know, 19 years old or so. And the man had one of those baby Bjorns, and they had a very, very tiny infant in the baby Bjorn. Like, he was wearing it in front of him, and they sat behind me. And I just was like, you kidding, right? You really kidding me? I mean, and not like you have to worry, like, oh, they're going to see the movie. It's inappropriate. But, you know, it's a loud movie with, like, machine guns. And, like, I just didn't understand. I'm like, why are you bringing your infant, like, the tiniest baby to the movie theater? And so they were sitting behind us. And then right before the trailers began, they left. And I was like, And the baby wasn't crying or anything like that. And they weren't fighting. Like, there was nothing. They were sitting there just fine, like nothing, waiting for the movie to begin. And then as soon as it was, they got up and left.
Yeah.
So that was quite interesting. But I was glad because I envisioned myself watching this film with a screaming baby behind me. So, yeah.
You know, I guess it does make sense to include Death Proof in this one because according to actress Marley Shelton, Robert and Quentin really co-directed Planet Terror, it says. Quentin was on set a lot. He had notes and adjustments to our performances. He changed lines every once in a while. And
What, for Planet Terror?
Yeah. And she says...
He was in it. He had a pretty big, not a big role, but a substantial role in the film.
Mm-hmm. And then he says, and vice versa for Death Proof. So it's really both of their brainchilds.
Well, they produced both movies. Mm-hmm. Both of them produced both movies. And yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure they collaborated a lot. You know, first of all, I think even when they're not doing movies together, I think they, because they have a friendship and a mutual respect, I think they, you know, like, that's like if I was doing something and I called you and was like, hey, Justin, what do you think of this? You know, it's like a similar thing. And so And you could tell, right? You could kind of tell the influence they have on each other, mm-hmm. I think, too, in their filmmaking. Yeah. See, I'm not surprised.
And then another guy that appears in multiple Rodriguez roles, Michael Parks played Earl McGraw, the sheriff, the quick draw McGraw sheriff in
Planet Terror. Yeah.
Yeah, he was in From Dusk Till Dawn, uh-huh. and I guess, he was in Death Proof, too, where they had that little segment where they were walking down the hallway, and Marley Shelton's character, she was the daughter of Earl McGraw, she right. was in it Planet as well, Terror. So that was kind of cool how they the two worlds collided when they were in the hospital after the car crash, so I like mm-hmm. that. So.
Yeah.
But yeah, that... Man, I loved all the stories that are going on in Planet Terror because there's multiple storylines going on. And they just, all of them, they came to a concluded in a satisfying way.
Yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, it was definitely one of those situations where there's a lot of things going on, but you're interested in each storyline that's happening, and mm-hmm. they do all seem to wrap up good. One thing I did like, though, is that they had the missing reel.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and that was pretty cool because you're definitely like, oh, I want it. First of all, the missing reel has the remainder of the sex scene, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it also has the story of El Rey. Remember? Because once Nick says missing reel, you know, and then next thing you know, they come back and he's like, I didn't know you were El Rey. I wouldn't mm-hmm. have bothered you so much. And it's like, no problem. And so obviously this... You know, character has an amazing past that we are not privy to.
Yeah.
So one day it would be good to see that. You know, what was the deal with that? But that was supposed to be another joke.
Yeah.
Like another Grindhouse type of joke where, you know, the movie theaters, you know, wouldn't have every reel of the mm-hmm. film. Things would be missing.
Yeah. And as much as we love... Well, at least Planet Terror. I know you didn't like Death Proof, but I love Grindhouse as a whole because not only the two movies, but the fake trailers in between. And
yeah.
If you have a chance, they're all on YouTube. I would definitely say if you didn't get a chance to see Grindhouse in the theater, make sure you check out those fake trailers because all of them are done by guest directors. There's a Eli Roth, like you said earlier, he did Thanksgiving.
And Edgar Wright.
Yeah,
right?
My favorite was Edgar Wright's Don't.
Oh, that was hysterical.
Rob Zombie did Zombie Werewolf Women of the SS.
She-Wolf of the SS.
And with a nice cameo by Nicolas Cage. I think that was Nicolas Cage's best role of his career. So if you want to see that, see him play Fu Manchu. And, of course, Machete. So all of those, I would definitely say look those up. I enjoyed all of them.
I don't want to see the Don't movie, though.
Well, that's
it was hilarious because it was mocking the way they make these horror trailers. You know, like if you want to, what is it? Something like that. Like if you thinking about going in that room, don't,
yeah.
You know, so it's like you're laughing because it's a parody. So please don't make the Don't movie.
I could see I'm kind of that way. Like I said, I was that way with Machete. I was happy with it being a fake trailer. I'm happy with Thanksgiving. I don't necessarily need Thanksgiving movie.
I don't need a Thanksgiving movie either.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So I think this trend of B-movie or exploitation movies coming out now, I think we've hit our peak with Machete after, like we said, Black Dynamite, Machete, the Grindhouse movies, and Piranha 3D. I'm sure we're going to get more, but... hopefully audiences will start getting tired of these and we won't see them anymore.
Or if we do get more, I hope they're spaced out. Like, I hope it's not like we get so many a year. I mean, if we get one a year, I guess that's not so terrible, right? Mm-hmm. But if it's like everyone has to jump on that bandwagon, then no thanks.
Yeah. Now, I could see why this may not have done very well at the box office. I don't know. Did I say this already? I think this is... Robert Rodriguez's lowest grossing movie.
No, you didn't say that.
I think they didn't really release the box office figures because they were both combined as one movie. But
for Grindhouse.
Yeah, I think out of all of his movies, this is probably the one that did the lowest. Just
opening, you mean?
From a budget to a gross.
Okay.
So I think it definitely did the least amount of film. I'm going to pull up those numbers in a second. But while I do that, I wanted to mention Roger Ebert's review of Grindhouse as a whole brought up kind of an interesting point, and I think this is has to do with why the movie did not do so well at the theaters. Roger Ebert says, but let's face it, the fundamental reason young males went to schlock double features in the golden age was in the hope of seeing breasts, or lacking that, stuff blowed up real good. Now that the mainstream is showing lots of breasts and real big explosions, there's no longer a market for bad movies showing the same thing.
Right.
So I think that's kind of, that's a good point, where a lot of the exploitation movies, they went away because the Hollywood big budget movies brought the same thing, but with a bigger budget, with better acting, like, it's just better. So making these movies that are purposefully doing that, it's not providing the same thing that they used to provide, I guess. So that's one thing, but you and I both still loved all of these movies.
Well, yeah, because it's nostalgic, and it's a cool way to present it, right?
Yeah.
Because it's not the norm.
Yeah. But like the people who are seeing it now for the first time, like we have a friend who will not be named, but he did not have cable growing up, so he didn't see a lot of movies. And Grindhouse is one of those movies that he did not see in the theater. He told me he watched them later on DVD. And
well, I think he was only 13 when it came out. Right?
So a lot of the younger audience today don't have that, because I didn't have that experience of seeing these type of Grindhouse movies. So it's playing to a certain audience.
I'm older than you, and I didn't.
Yeah. But it's playing to a certain audience that may not exist. Well, they're only there for the nostalgia and not to the younger audience. So you're not getting as many ticket sales as possible, I guess.
Right.
So the budget for Grindhouse overall was $53 million. Worldwide, it made $50 million. So it didn't even break even.
It didn't make its money back, yeah. Right?
Now, on DVD and Blu-ray, it's made $31 million. So it's now made its money back with the DVD sales thrown in there. But as I said, with all the previous Robert Rodriguez films, he's pretty much doubled or tripled his expenses. So that's
record, it was probably a bad idea to do Grindhouse, because you don't know, it's possible that his movie would have made money.
And now
he has that black mark on his record.
Yeah, we'll never know. Even The Faculty, which was a $15 million budget, made $40 million.
Right. So, yeah.
Yeah. Now, so, I did want to mention, did you get a chance to see his first movie called Bedhead?
No, I haven't.
It's on the El Mariachi DVD, which is a cool little feature. It's a 7-minute short film that he did, and every person in the cast is named Rodriguez, so I'm guessing they're all his family members.
Right.
But it's a really cute story of a little girl and her brother and her little sister, but she's not really in it that much. But the brother kind of torments the little sister, and he's got this horrendous bedhead that no matter what they do, she sprays him with a hose one time and it still pops right back up. It's a little black and white movie, and you can see it's just really entertaining, and it's a fun little film. So I would definitely recommend you go check it out. The girl ends up getting like superpowers, and anyway, it's a fun.
That's pretty a lot
short.
Of stuff for 7 minutes, you said.
Yeah, and it's just, you can tell right there his talent as a filmmaker, making that little short film, and stuff that he does, tricks with editing and stuff. You can see where later on, once he got a lot of different technology, he uses the same things that he's been using since 1991 when he did Bedhead, but now he's just got a lot bigger tools to play with.
Right.
So, again, with most of his movies, on that first one, he was a director, writer, composer, and cinematographer. So, up in the future.
Yeah, what is he doing besides Spy Kids 4, Armageddon?
That is coming out in 2011. And all of these don't have official dates yet, but he's currently working on Red Sonja, which at one point was going to star Rose McGowan, but I don't know if she's still signed on for that movie or not.
Yeah, I'm not sure because I read about how, you know, supposedly while they were doing Planet Terror, they fell in love, right? And him and his wife had separated.
Oh, man, I didn't hear that.
Oh, yeah, him and his wife. First of all, everyone thought that he was having an affair with Rose McGowan while he was doing Planet Terror, but then it came out that him and his wife were actually separated long before Planet Terror, but they had decided to produce the film anyway. Like, they had told the studio, like, look, we're separating, what have you, but, you know, it's amicable, and we're going to produce the film together anyway. Like, his wife is a producer on a lot of his films. So, and so he landed up with Rose McGowan, and then I think that was part of why he went for the Red Sonja property, so that she could be the lead. And then I read that they actually landed up breaking up because, like, they couldn't get it off the ground, and they were arguing about the movie. So I don't know if it's still happening. If it's, I don't know. Like, it's pretty up in the air now.
Yeah. And he's just going to be a producer on that one. I'm sorry, he's not going to be directing that one.
Right, yeah, he's producing.
Another one he's producing is the comic book adaptation of, or the adaptation of the comic book Mad Men. Mm-hmm. So, or Mad Man, I'm sorry.
Mad Man, yeah.
That's another one. And the two that he has coming down the directing pipe is the sequel to Sin City and another movie called Nerve Wrackers.
Yeah, I don't really know about that one.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly.
Sin City 2, I'm curious about. Like, I feel like because it was so stylized the first time, is it going to feel like you're just watching the same exact movie again?
Yeah.
Especially since he used, like, there's, like, I don't know how many graphic novels, 6 or 7 or something like that.
I think it's 7.
He used the stories from a lot of those graphic novels. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's the second one, I think, or something like that, A Dame to Kill For, or something like that. Mm-hmm. That, I think he's going to do Sin City 2, but I feel like, is it going to look and feel like you're watching the same movie again?
Yeah. If we go to our friends over at Box Office Mojo, the top 10 highest grossing films of Robert Rodriguez's career, the first three Spy Kids, of course, have the top spots there. The second movie made $197 million, the third one $119 million, and the first one $147 million. Sin City made $158 million. Once Upon a Time in Mexico, $98 million. The Faculty, $40 million. Sharkboy and Lavagirl, $60 million. I don't know what the order is here, because these numbers are kind of...
No, I know. I'm looking at it, too, and I'm like, the numbers are not in order, so I don't know what they're talking about. Actually, I think they... No, they did. They did screw up the order. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. These aren't alphabetical.
It's not even by release date, either, so I don't know how they ranked it.
So, okay, Sharkboy and Lavagirl, 69, and then From Dusk Till Dawn, Desperado, and Grindhouse all made $25 million. So they've got $25 million listed as the gross for Grindhouse, or for Planet Terror, I should say.
Right.
And so that's, if you total those all up, $590 million with an average of $54 million per film. So he's done well in his career.
And that's only directing.
Oh, yeah.
That's not even talking about the films he's produced. Like, he just produced Predators.
Yeah.
And that did well.
Mm-hmm. And, oh, I forgot to mention, again, with his buddy Quentin Tarantino, he directed a piece of the movie Four Rooms in 1995, where it was four different stories shot by four different directors. So I have yet to see that movie, but I do have it sitting in front of my DVD player, so I haven't checked that one out yet.
Let me know. I'll check it out.
Yeah, Tim Roth is in it, apparently, from... He's in all four movies. Yeah. He kind of strings them together. But that'll be interesting, and I'll let you know, Eve.
Very cool. Very cool.
So that was our look at Robert Rodriguez. Oh! at the end of Machete, there was a tease where it said, coming soon, Machete Kills, and then Machete Kills Again.
Again, right?
So they
left the door open for that one.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see if it happens. I don't know. Is it going to happen?
No.
I don't know. I think the movie's got to make a little bit more money for a sequel to No, you know what we need? We need immediately the Machete reboot.
Yeah!
Come on, get to work.
Yeah.
So, next week, I don't know, what are we going to talk about? Oh, next week, we're going to take a look at the Resident Evil franchise.
Yay!
Since the fourth movie is coming out. So, come back next week for that.
And don't forget, if you want to email us, you can do it flicksofdoom@gmail.com. You can find us on Twitter @flicksofdoom. And remember, that's F-L-I-X. And you can also find us both on geeksofdoom.com.
I'm gonna eat your brains and gain your knowledge. I can't say it. Justin, man. Why are you doing this to me? Tell me why. Tell me why.
To put this at the beginning.
No. I'm gonna delete it. I'll delete it off the... Gonna delete it. Okay, I'm ready. Okay. And one, and two.